Hello, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along with us today. There was an article in the New York Times, in the section Science Times yesterday, a headline, Political Animal, Yes, Animals. Brainy species, brawny species that campaign across sophisticated and far-flung social networks. We're going to talk about that today. Because, as you can see in the 2008 presidential race, there are many ways to grab on to political power. You can ally with males like Chuck Norris or females like Oprah. And researchers studying a number of animals, non-human animals, like elephants, rhesus monkeys, baboons, dolphins, sperm whales, and wolves, are uncovering evidence that the creatures engage in extraordinarily sophisticated forms of politicking, often across large and far-flung networks. We're going to talk about this first with George Wittemeyer, who is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California in Berkeley. And it's a pleasure to have George Wittemeyer on the phone with us today. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. Thank you so much. I noticed that you are quoted in the article that I referred to in the New York Times yesterday, especially with elephants. You are an elephant researcher?
Yeah, correct. I've been working on a specific elephant population in northern Kenya, the Samburu elephant population, actually, for the past going on 11 years now.
All right. And for people who would like to join the conversation at any point along the way, the telephone number for this hour is different than you would normally call. Instead of calling the Milwaukee numbers, we're in Madison today. And the number here in Madison is 263-1890. Or, of course, you can use our toll-free number at 800-642-1234. And we invite emails at talk@wpr.org. Talking with George Wittemeyer. George, among elephants, is it the males or the females who are the born politicians?
I guess probably both are a bit, but the more complex social structures really with the female groups. And the males are much more independent and focus solely on their own well-being, whereas females have to really pay attention to the other members of the population and other factors in the population to make sure that their group and their children and their extended families are going to be doing okay.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about this sort of extended version of friends and family, how many animals might we be talking about?
So with a typical elephant family, they might have around 10 individuals where they have a very tight core group. That would be similar to the nuclear family in our own societies. And then they have hierarchical complexity with multiple levels, actually, in their social structure. They get successively larger. And in the end, you're talking, we don't even know probably where their knowledge actually extends to in relation to individual recognition and things like that. But they would know easily 100 or so individuals.
Hmm. And how do they communicate with them across these many miles of savanna and plain?
So elephants are an interesting species. We all know elephants are famous for their large noses. So actually their olfactory capabilities are very important to them, and a lot of their communication is probably through chemical pheromones and the like. But which makes it very difficult for us to study because we aren't that great of an olfactory species.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that a lot of researchers have been focusing in on is their ability to use infrasonic vocal communications. And infrasound is sort of sub-level sonic waves from what we can hear. And as such, it's very low frequency and it can travel very far. So for elephants, they've been recorded to pretty regularly communicate at least a kilometer across the savannas. And if atmospheric conditions are correct, they believe that these vocal communications can actually go 10, you know, around 10, maybe 15 kilometers.
So these are vocal communications and not pawing or stomping the earth or something like that?
No. There's also some work, actually, that's been done on seismic communication with elephants, too, which is quite exciting, where they actually are able to pick up, because of the mass of an elephant, they can actually pick up the seismic waves created by elephants walking at some distance. We're not really sure how far or how much they use this skill, but they have very sensitive feet that can pick up vibrations in the earth. And the researchers doing this work believe that they can actually pick up, if a group of elephants is in distress and charging and running, they can actually pick that up in their feet and respond if they need to.
Is there any evidence that when the tsunami struck Indonesia, what was it, 2 years ago or so, that elephants recognized what was coming and they, among other animals, headed for higher ground?
Certainly there's been some anecdotal stories to that effect that they have gotten out of the way. It's hard to verify some of that work. There was one research group that had radio collars on elephants in Sri Lanka, where the tsunami, one of the countries the tsunami hit, and they found no real evidence that the elephants moved away from the shore. It appeared that those elephants weren't actually hit by the tsunami either, so they may have been in locations where they didn't need to move. So, as you know, from piecing together stories, it looks like certainly some may have gotten out of the way and probably others did not, and it's pretty difficult to tell.
George Wittemeyer is our guest. He's from the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management, and is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California in Berkeley, and studies elephants. Elephants are among the animals that are named in this story in the New York Times yesterday that deals with their sort of political lives as well. When someone said they were doing a story about this, do you see as you research a lot of political ties and allegiances among elephants?
Certainly. I think cooperation is, you know, basically the two major forces in societies are sort of conflict and cooperation, and both drive any social organism's interactions with each other. So, you know, with elephants, they will have members of the population and members of their group who they tend to cooperate with more regularly, maybe even all the time, and they'll have other members that, for whatever reasons, they tend to have more conflict with, the same as we find with us. So you know, these baseline factors really are the same in any political system or social system, as you want to call it.
If you'd like to join the conversation, we have a couple lines open. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Elsewhere, toll-free at 800-642-1234. That's a little bit different than you're used to at this hour of the day. But Kathleen Dunn is away, and so we're doing the program from Madison using the Madison numbers, 263-1890 and 1-800-642-1234. And let's bring a caller into this conversation. That's Mark in Colfax. Hello, Mark. What's on your mind today?
I had seen a program about rhinos where they were trying to bring back their numbers, so they put them in a park and had a breeding program, and for some reason they were finding something was killing the rhinos, including crushing their bones. And what they found out was that in the same park they had a population of young teenage bull elephants which were becoming increasingly aggressive and killing the rhinos. And I guess what I understand is they figured out they needed to get some older elephants in there in the population, and those older elephants made the youngsters toe the line, and from then on they had no problems. I wonder if he knows about that or what relationship was going on there.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. You've said that quite well. It's an interesting case where, you know, there's a lot of disrupted animal populations across the world, and elephants particularly seem to be susceptible to these disruptions. And that case was in South Africa, and they had very young teenage elephants that essentially started doing deviant behavior, including killing other animals such as rhino. And yes, they introduced adult, fully mature males who then immediately, in effect, it seemed like the teenage male's hormones were suppressed by the presence of this large male, and his probably his chemical communication helped to calm their very active teenage hormones, and the behavior subsided subsequently.
And has the rhino population grown then since that time?
The deviant behavior with those elephants actually killing rhinos has stopped. The rhinos in general are not doing ultimately well. They're a tricky species because their horn is so valuable. It's on the, you're dealing with, same thing with elephants actually. The tusks are, make it complicated to protect them because they're so valuable. But rhino horn is, at a gram per dollar basis, is sort of the price of heroin or some very coveted drug. And so, as we know, the wars that go on around drugs, the same thing happens with wildlife products that are worth that much as well. So rhino in general are still very much on the edge of which direction they're going to fall, and it really depends on the management capabilities for that population, if they're doing well or not.
Mark, thank you very much for the call, and we appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Gail next in Door County. Hello, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm on my cell here, too. I do a lot of sensory and telepathic communication with animals as a professional in the area and in the Midwest and actually nationally. And when I was doing a lot of sensory work into the different species of animals, try to pull out the way that the animals in general communicate, there is this sensory vibration that they're able to pick up. And it's interesting that I'm getting such wonderful confirmation here about their sensory ability in their feet, that they can feel these vibrations. But there's also, with the way that their entire structure is put together, they can feel vibrations on the wind. It's not just the wind, but that's all these other things that they're very sensory, and they can sense all of these invisible vibrations that are really difficult to meter and register with regular physical equipment for scientific research. But it's all of that in the airwaves and the vibrations in the ground that is coming in and really upsetting them, and upsetting their immune systems because of this erratic vibration that's increasing through the decades because of all of this additional chaos in the frequencies that man is causing. And there's people that have written books about the emotional sensory information that animals get, and that connection that the elephants in particular get. And I'm wondering, have you done any of that, bringing in any of that kind of information into your research to get even deeper into this subtle life of the animal population, of and elephants in particular, because they are so incredibly dynamic and such a powerful connection to the earth for all species?
My research is primarily focused on broader population level questions in the wild. These sensory questions on elephants, I think there's definitely a lot of room for investigation. Probably the best place to do that would be more in a zoo-type setting where you can control more of the inputs coming into the system or that the elephant is receiving, and you can observe very closely what's going on. It's a bit difficult to do some of that in the wild. But certainly we've had, you can see this with humans as well. When we get people from, for example, Manhattan who come out and visit us in the field site where it's a very different atmosphere for them. They people from cities tend to not be able to see, smell, hear, or notice anything in the bush, so to speak. And you can just see that their senses have been dampened, probably by all this background noise they're constantly having to filter through, and just the silence and the and the subtle cues that you hear in nature, they're very, very slow to pick up on those. And I always found that to be quite entertaining, actually.
Now, that sensory boundary is really extensive. The more they're out in the wild and the longer they are. And it's why feral cats are so feral, because their sensory system is to cover such a wide radius. But the problem is, too, that I was also sending letters to some of the zoos when these elephants started to die mysteriously. And the problem that they have is they really shouldn't be in the zoos on concrete, because that actually inhibits their immune systems, which shortens their lifespan and actually is very upsetting for them emotionally in that. But, you know, whether they're going to do anything like that and understand any of that in zoos, it's just really, really sad about, the plight of the elephant and how upset they are as a collective, like the aspen. They're all connected, and elephants in their total population are like aspens, even if they aren't in the same country and in the same vicinity. And I think that's, you know, really important for a lot of people to even start to consider, that is how deep they go in their connection, even if they physically aren't together. They do remember, and they do have this sense about them.
And that is one of the factors in that they do have this remarkable memory, and it persists all through their life, does it not, George?
Yes. One of the interesting things, back to the political spin on this whole thing that we found with elephants, is that their dominance relationships are very acutely developed, and they know sort of who they are and where they are in the dominance hierarchy at a much greater scale than just within their limited groups. And what we've found is that older individuals, regardless of their size, even quite small females that are much older, will tend to be dominant to their larger, younger counterparts. And it appears that this is really a learned behavior. That, you know, at a young age, they sort of learn where they are in the dominance hierarchy, and they don't really challenge that too much, and they sort of respect their elders, so to speak. And they, again, it reflects this their ability to recognize other individuals and where they are in the dominance in the social structure of the entire population, that they're able to, over time, remain in the same relationship with these other individuals. So it really speaks to that memory ability.
Gail, thank you so much for your observations, and we appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is George Wittemeyer, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California in Berkeley. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Catherine McKinnon, who is an assistant professor of anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice and Center for International Studies at St. Louis University. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and happy to have you along with us today. Our program is sparked by a column, a story written in the New York Times Science Times section yesterday by Natalie Angier about political animals, yes, animals that actually campaign across very sophisticated and far-flung social networks. We've been hearing about Elephant Society from George Wittemeyer of the University of California in Berkeley. And in a little bit, we'll be talking about this with a professor of anthropology at St. Louis University, Catherine McKinnon. So one thing I guess we've determined is that Elephant Society is a matriarchy.
Correct.
And that age has its privileges when it comes to Elephant Society.
Certainly.
Talk about this core group of elephants, the maybe 10 or a dozen that you mentioned. Does the matriarch get the final decision about all things affecting that herd?
Certainly she's the major decision maker, but as with any group or any family, there will be disagreements amongst different individuals. And typically she is the leader of the group and either decides where they're going to go or possibly what's needed most by the group, but this may not reflect specific individual needs, and at that time there will be disagreement.
And with a lifespan that rivals ours, these elephants are said to have some of the most elaborate social networks ever yet observed. And when you've been studying these, have you seen anything that came as a surprise to you or something you hadn't expected when you're viewing and watching and researching?
I guess we hear a lot of lore about elephants from the time we're quite young. So parceling out what's true and what's not is always is a trick. And as a scientist, I mean, as doing my scientific training as I have been during this research, it's always been a bit of a interesting position to be in. And we do come across very exciting, very interesting things that we don't really have a proper explanation for, such as we know there's these legends about elephant graveyards, but actually what we see is elephants do have, there aren't these actual elephant graveyards, but there is a very interesting interaction with elephants and death, and they're fascinated by other dead elephants. And this has been something that is you encounter in the field, and you see elephants run into their dead conspecifics and interact with them and investigate the carcasses. And it's something that's very difficult to explain from a scientific rationale basis. And it just points to the complexity and intelligence of the species.
Mm-hmm. Have you studied any other animals, such as baboons or dolphins or wolves?
I haven't been involved in specific studies of those species. Mm-hmm. I've primarily been working on elephants.
When you look at the political campaigns that are going on now, do you see any resemblance between what they're doing and the elephant herds that you study?
Certainly. I think there's always cozying up to with who will make your life easier, and I think that's a lesson from across, you can see with any animals. It's always to your benefit to be in a coalition with those who you can benefit from. And we see that going on today with the presidential candidates, and we see it going on with basically all social animals.
All right, George, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Been a real pleasure. George Wiedemeyer is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California in Berkeley. And in just a few moments, we'll be talking with Catherine McKinnon, Assistant Professor of Anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice and the Center for International Studies at St. Louis University. The program is occasioned by an article in Science Times, yesterday in the New York Times, written by Natalie Angier. And she says, as the candidates have shown us in this telenova that is the 2008 presidential race, there are many ways to parry for political power. And you can seek the measured endorsement of town elders or the restless energy of the young, showily handle strange infants or furtively slam your opponents, just as they do in the animal world. So we'll be talking about that with a researcher who's very much involved with wolves. I mean, monkeys, rhesus monkeys, who are considered to be the quintessential opportunists. They pretend they're helping others, but they only help adults, not infants. They are helping those who are higher in rank than they are, intervening in fights where they know they're going to win and where the risk of injured is small. In sum, this researcher says, rhesus monkeys try to gain maximal benefits at minimum cost, and it's a strategy that seems to work. We have our second guest with us now. She is Catherine McKinnon, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at St. Louis University. And Catherine, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
When it comes to primates, researchers say the paradox of a highly social species like rhesus monkeys and humans is that our complex sociology is the reason for our success and also the source of our greatest troubles. That holds true with monkeys, too, then?
It certainly does, in part. If you think about, the people with whom you love the most and fight the most, those are the people closest to you, and I think that holds true in primate groups as well. So primates are, as you know and as you've been talking about and as the article discusses a bit, well-known and long-studied as living in these stable social groups, and they have extended communities and extended social networks, and are very successful at maneuvering through a really complicated landscape, if you will, of complex social relationships. And so sociality is really the, you know, hold the glue that holds these groups together, and the way that, that the animals get along within those groups is very important to consider.
Do, as some claim, rhesus monkeys embody the concept Machiavellian?
They are now well known to. And actually, there's some very interesting points in that New York Times article I'd like to talk about.
Sure.
Daria Mastropieri has done amazing work on rhesus monkeys and looking at some of these issues. And rhesus monkeys, like many macaques, live in groups with strong matrilines, that is, these extended networks that go through back generations of related females that provide the real core of the group. And in that, in those types of social structures, we can see some of these real kind of kin-based kind of situations for preferential care for those more closely related to certain members of the matrilines, the higher-ranking females versus those that aren't. And what's important to point out is when you're looking at some of these issues with primates, there are so many variable strategies that many different species employ and many different social networks that characterize different species. So if you want to find an explanation or provide proof for an explanation of a certain theory or hypothesis, you can do it by picking any one of the 250-plus species of primates out there. So some demonstrate this what's been called this Machiavellian you know, political maneuvering and out to do good for yourself type of strategy. But I think it's also important to highlight the fact that there are a number of other species that don't show that real strict type of political, so-called, you know, out for yourself type of political maneuvering.
Mm-hmm. If individual monkeys do not fight for food, space, or resources, do they just fight for status?
And yeah, that's, I think, what Dr. Mastropieri's quote is in that. And there's some sense in that. I think when we're looking at primate sociality, basically the main kind of goal, if you will, of living in a social group is to get along. And primates have amazing ways in which they do this and very, you know, sophisticated variable strategies. And there has been a lot of attention paid to this kind of Machiavellian, as it's been called, this fierce political kind of conceptualization.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side of that, the other side of the coin, is the role of cooperation and social complexity in the evolution of sociality. And basically, when you look at, you know, if you go out and watch a group of monkeys all day for weeks and months and years, the day-to-day interactions are often characterized by little to no fighting or jousting. And sometimes it can be rather boring, as fascinating as they are to watch in the wild, which is what I do. But, you know, day in, day out, there's relatively little drama if you watch them for long periods of time. Now, as your previous guest correctly pointed out, you know, both cooperation and conflict have roles to play. But what many have written about recently, and I'll mention a few seminal papers and some good books that are out there now, shortly, the role of cooperation and mediation and negotiation in primate lives in groups has kind of been overshadowed by looking at this, you know, the what has been assumed to be the primary role of aggression and conflict in social groups. So there's some really interesting work done now, a paper a couple years ago by Paul Garber at the University of Illinois and Bob Sussman at Washington University here in St. Louis, and also Augustine Fuentes at the University of Notre Dame, some work done on both popular writings and also in the scientific literature on looking at the role of cooperation in the evolution of sociality and kind of bringing that more to the forefront instead of really focusing on these, you know, kind of selfish political type of strategies that have been promulgated.
You mentioned books. Is that do they have in common a book to recommend?
Yeah, there's several out now. In terms of popular books, there's actually one that is written by Donna Hart and Bob Sussman called Man the Hunted, Primates, Predators, and Human Evolution. It really takes to task this notion that that we've in human evolution anyway, and they bring in a lot of great primate examples too, that we've been, you know, the dominating kind of hunter throughout our evolutionary history. And actually what they've shown with a lot of nice examinations of data sets is that we've been prey for the majority of our evolutionary history, and that the predation effects have been, you know, probably one of the central reasons that sociality and social group living began in the primate lineage to begin with. So I would recommend that one. And there's another book called The Origins and Nature of Sociality that's edited by Bob Sussman, and that one's a very nice collection of papers. And also, if I could, just dropping names here and looking at my bookshelf, but looking at some really nice work that that Franz de Waal has done on this. And actually, it's his book in the 80s called Chimpanzee Politics that really started this use of the wording political and politics in looking at primate interactions. And famously, probably, his book Chimpanzee Politics was on the, it probably still is, on Newt Gingrich's kind of top 10 list of readings that he would used to recommend to all freshman members of Congress to read, so they could get a better understanding of kind of the political maneuverings that chimpanzees are so good at. And you know, it's a humorous kind of anthropomorphic use of the word, I think. We can get into trouble if we take it too literally, as we can do with any kind of anthropomorphic words, because it has a lot of significance and baggage attached to it in our human conceptions of the, you know, the word politics and political. So we have to keep that in mind when we're ascribing that sort of human construct to an animal society or animal social group.
Catherine MacKinnon is our guest. She's an assistant professor of anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice and the Center for International Studies at St. Louis University. We have lines open if you have comments or questions about political animals. Our number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Those numbers are different than what you're used to at this time of day, since we're broadcasting from Madison and not from Milwaukee. Use our Madison numbers, 263-1890 or 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. We'll take calls and talk more with Catherine MacKinnon in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on this Wednesday morning. In about 20 minutes or so, Larry Mueller will be in, and amphibians are disappearing from the Earth at an alarming rate. After 11, Larry will be talking about 2008 Year of the Frog with Aaron O'Brien of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Kevin Zippel of Amphibian Arc. That's coming up at 11 here on the Ideas Network. We continue to talk about the social structures of some of nature's most intelligent and complex species. And our guest is Catherine MacKinnon, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at St. Louis University. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. We've been talking about monkeys, which is what Catherine MacKinnon studies. And do all male primates pursue power by appealing to other men, or are there exceptions to that?
There, as with, you know, anything, any question or topic that you apply to primates, there are a number of exceptions to any rule that you might think exists if you scratch the surface. So while, yes, there are many, you know, species that have strong bonds between males in the species, common chimpanzees are an obvious example, and one that's been studied, a species that's been studied a long time, and with regards to male coalitions and male bonding among related and unrelated males, I might add, too. Very interesting. There are a number of species, most notably baboons and several New World monkey species, where males really curry favor with the females in the group. And as was noted, I think, in that article, and also very similar to elephants, as was just discussed, in many primate species, the sex that disperses or leaves, usually during adolescence or early adulthood, sometimes earlier, is the male. Now, there are exceptions to that, chimpanzees being one of them. But in most species, most of the 250-plus species we have out there of non-human primates, the males disperse, so you're left with these core groups of females, some of whom are related, as the kind of central component of the group. And so new males coming in often not only have to kind of fight their way up literally or through social maneuvering to get into the group in a good place, but they really have to get approval, if you will, of from the females in the group. And the older alpha females typically are the ones that, you know, can vote them in or vote them out, so to speak, to use the political verbiage a little bit.
So if a monkey's born, it's female, her status is determined in one way, and the male sort of has to fight his way up the ladder.
Yeah, and it's a little, you know, as with all of these things, much more complex than that. And, again, there are a lot of differences as you look, not only across species, but within species in different locations, which is fascinating, too. Makes it a little difficult to make absolute statements, but mm-hmm. It also makes it very intriguing and keeps us asking questions and keeps us going out there and taking data. But, yes, females, if we're talking about these ones where females for most of their lives stay in a group where they're born, they have somewhat different strategies than the males do that might be coming in terms of how they maneuver. Some really good work that's been done for decades on baboons. One of the researchers, the New York Times article mentioned Barbara Smuts from University of Michigan and also Shirley Strom at University of California, San Diego. They both looked at the importance of friendships in baboons between males and females. And some of these are non-sexual friendships, and some involve at some point in their lives maybe a sexual component of the relationship as well, but it's not necessary. And these friendships, as they've been called, appropriately so, can go on for decades. And so that type of, strong social interaction and relationships are really crucial for determining quote-unquote success in a group. And again, you know, the point of living in a social group is to basically have some stability, protection, get along day to day, and not to be fighting it out every day. So they're really good at often in very subtle ways, using really subtle mechanisms, some of which might not even be apparent to us in terms of communication, figuring out how to deal with little problems and tiffs and things like that.
Where do you do your observing of these monkeys?
I work primarily on a group of monkeys called capuchin monkeys that are commonly known as the traditional organ grinder monkeys,
mm-hmm.
Popular in entertainment film and unfortunately popular as pets as well, but have been for a long time. And I work in Central America, mainly in Costa Rica and a little bit in Nicaragua. And then the last 3 or 4 years I've been in Suriname, which is in northern South America, looking at a different type of capuchin monkey, but still a capuchin monkey. So.
And do their behaviors pretty much stay consistent? Capuchin here, capuchin there?
In a general sense, yes. But then one of the things that I'm interested in is I look at infant and juvenile social development and how they learn the skills that they need to survive socially and also foraging techniques and getting food and things like that. And there's a lot of individual difference and temperament differences that play a role in how these animals will become adults and what type of successful adults. So social development and really getting back to that kind of, you know, political savvy type of, aspect of that article is very important because there is a lot of individual difference. Now, there are certain things, certain types of, you know, alarm calls that can characterize a species and things like that. But once you look at a group or several groups in a population, there's a lot of individual variation in certain behaviors.
The primatologist at the University of Chicago says that fighting is never something that occurs between two individuals. When we think about the political debates that have been going on television, you see a lot of back and forth between people. But in the wild, with monkeys and the monkeys you're studying, the fighting is sort of mitigated by the number of outside influences. Others get involved.
Yeah, and you also, I mean, as a young primate growing up, you're very aware of not only your place in the group, but your mother's place in the group primarily, and also once you're mobile and away from mom and can navigate, can run around on your own, you start to learn the importance of peer networks, peer support, and everyone else's relationships, not only to you, but to everyone else in the group. So if you have a group of, you know, typical group of, say, capuchin monkeys, 15 to 20 individuals in the species in Costa Rica, the white-faced capuchin monkeys, that's a lot of, you know, social networks and basically social webs to keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
So they get very, his point making that was, you know, there might be a little fight or scuffle with two individuals, but those two are linked to, you know, social networks that extend beyond those two individuals, and they're very well aware of you know, as I said, the other's place in the group, and it's not a static thing. Those are shifting, dynamic social qualities as well. So, and that actually gets to an interesting point I want to make about the alpha, because that's always brought up in these, you know, political analogies. Al Gore famously wanted to, you know, remake himself as an alpha male and sought advice for that in the last campaign. And, you know, this notion that is, you know, fun to think about, and we often use it in a very kind of nonchalant and sometimes sloppy way, but that the alpha male really signifies this, you know, all-powerful, all-encompassing person in the group or in the, you know, community. And what we find in primates is that, you know, the status of alpha, whether you're a male or female, is really a state, not an inherent trait, as we like to say. So an individual isn't born to be alpha from the time they're an infant. Now, in some of these species, like macaques, we have these strong matrilines. Dominance does kind of get socially inherited through those networks. But in many species, it's really dependent on the temperament of the individual, and also the other players in the group, the social context. So you can take an alpha male in one group and pick him up and plop him down in another group, and if the actors have changed, he may very well not be alpha in that group. He might be beta, gamma, whatever. And also, the position of alpha isn't a lifelong one. So the animals, male or female, if they're at the top of the rank, and again, these are our kind of perceptions of who's at the top, and we use different variables to try to tease that out. But they might be in that position for 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, depends on the species, and then they might not be. And there's also some work done, fantastic work done by Robert Sapolsky at Stanford University, that looks at the role of hormones and particularly cortisol levels with dominant status. And, you know, the alpha male is, the alpha position, male or female, is not always a very comfortable place to be. You have to kind of keep aware of your status and look at maybe some trouble coming up underneath you, and sometimes the more middle ranked males are more calm and more kind of relaxed in terms of cortisol levels than the top ranking.
Let's take some calls, and you can talk with Catherine McKinnon here. Joseph is first in Wilton. Joseph, what's on your mind today?
Hi, sir. How are you doing?
Good.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
Yes, I was just wondering. I'm a student at UW-Baraboo, Wisconsin, and I've tossed around with the idea of, you know, creationism and stuff like that. And I was wondering, in reverse engineering, normally when we take apart things, we can discover where they come from, like from what corporation, who designed it originally.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if the theory is just hard to prove in animals and in science in general, if like, you know, because of like invisible God or whatever, if that's why it's harder to be caught on to in the science world. And I was wondering your answer on that.
I'm not quite clear what you're asking, but I think you might be asking, I mean, one of the things that gets tossed around a lot with primate sociality is kind of the roots of ethics or morality. Is that kind of getting at?
Yeah.
That's a topic that has been tossed around for a few hundred years, actually, in terms of philosophy of science, kind of the notion of... And this is, you bring up a very good point of, it ties into this biological basis of human behavior, and primates being so biologically close to us, phylogenetically close to us, our closest living relatives, they're often used as these models for what is, you know, incorrectly the analogy of the onion. You strip away the layers, and what's at the core of our being underneath it all. And you know, there are many different ways to take that. And one of the, getting back to that kind of the Machiavellian political maneuvering type of strategy, one of the counterpoints to that is that really this strong sense of sociality and cooperation is an underlying social trait that we all share as primates, humans included. I'm not sure if that's even getting at your point, but this the roots of morality, very difficult to get at. That some have written, Franz de Waal, as I mentioned earlier, has written a bit about this, quite a bit as well. There's a book he wrote called Good Natured, which examines the origins of this in humans and other animals, looking at maybe these biological tendencies for being strongly social, strongly cooperative. Yes, there's conflict from time to time, but the overriding group of social behaviors that we engage in as primates as a whole are cooperative and supportive in nature. So is there something there with, you know, empathy has been brought in, you know, sensing what the other is feeling or how they'll react? Is that kind of at the basis for much later and with our very quite different central nervous system and brain structure evolved into these complex higher philosophical qualities that we have.
Joseph, I hope we've given you some answer to your question. And let's go next to Sarah in Powers Lake. Let's see. Sarah, there you are. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Great topic today. I just have a quick question about the differences in the matriarchal versus patriarchal primates that you find. Are there any distinct social differences when you look at the two and compare the two that you would find maybe in a matriarchal society that you don't find in a patriarchal society or vice versa as something minus the cultural differences between each primate groups?
Yeah, certainly. There are. That's a great question. As I mentioned before, with particularly macaques, which have been so well studied, you do have these really amazing matrilines of these females that are these, you know, some have called them, you know, these dynasties that go back generations of these very powerful females that you do not want to mess with. If you're even if you're the alpha male in the group, you don't mess with them. And those matrilines have very interesting kind of subcomponents to them, which we also find in other primate species, and that is what's really at work in that hierarchy. And again, not all primate species have these strict linear hierarchies that we think we see in some of them. What they have within them are these dyads and triads, these really interesting components that are sometimes not stable and shifting. So between individuals within those matrilines, you can have groups of two or three that might come together to, you know, give each other backing in certain situations, at other times not, and those are kind of changing casts of characters. And we don't seem to find that as much in those, and we don't really use the term patriline in the groups. Well, for one thing, there are very, by comparison, few primate species where the females all leave at, you know, when they get to reach adolescence and you get a core group of males. And some New World monkeys, spider monkeys, this occurs, and some other type of what are called Adeline monkeys in that group, and also chimpanzees. But you don't get the kind of related core groups of females that you see in what we call these matrilines, among the males, as much. So you do have male bonding, and in common chimpanzees, you really see this, that these friendships and support networks that go on for decades. But the characterizations are a little bit differently. Also, many species of primate, and there, again, are exceptions to this with everything I'm saying. You can find some species that offer up exceptions, but females are the big groomers and kind of social facilitators in many primate groups, and they'll spend, with macaques, hours and hours grooming each other, grooming males, and it really is, as it's been rightly called, the social glue that holds these relationships together or reinforces these social bonds. So males typically don't groom as much, and that's a big difference between males and females. Again, you can find exceptions. Last summer I watched a male, brown capuchin in Suriname groom an infant for over 40 minutes, and that's That's quite something for a male capuchin to have his concentration held that long by an infant and also to participate in grooming. So there are exceptions, but generally females are the ones that are the kind of mega groomers and do a lot of that day-to-day maintenance of these social networks via that.
Sarah, thank you very much for the call, and we're just about out of time. Just in a yes or no, a question was asked of George Whittemeyer earlier about telepathic communications among elephants. Do you sense that among monkeys?
Personally, that would be great if I could, but no, I haven't. You know, who knows? My dogs and cats, I think, often can communicate via these different pathways, call it what you will, that we can't tap into. Primates are see the world and sense the world in a very, very similar way to us, which actually makes them amazing to watch and look at, because a bit more than some other social mammals, we can kind of get a sense of how they hear the world, how they see the world. The previous guest talked about the infrasonic, subsonic, and olfactory pathways, chemical cues, et cetera, pheromones that elephants really use a lot.
Catherine, I'm sorry, I have to break in because we've run out of time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking about political animals in the landscape. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks for listening. Our thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for production today. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.